Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie, and this is episode number 165 for September 22nd, 2008, with bonus coverage of Whiskey Live Paris. I'm recording this episode on location at one of the world's most legendary bars, Harry's New York Bar in Paris. Every Parisian cabbie knows the address, 5 Rue Daunou. It's been uttered by legends and locals for nearly 100 years. Joining me at the bar, Terry Benatar, the managing director of La Maison de Whiskey and a semi-regular here at Harry's. Tell me about sort of the history of this place, because you've been coming here for many years, right?
Yes, in fact, this bar is really one of the most famous bars in Paris, not only for whiskey, but for cocktail as well. It was created in 1911, so it's the oldest bar in Paris, and it's very famous for being the first bar to create the Bloody Mary. So it's quite famous for some cocktails, and it was also one of the first bars in Paris to import some of the single malt whiskey. It was created by a Scottish-American, Mr. McKellen. Unfortunately, the founder and the son of the founder died, but the wife of the last founder, I mean, the wife of Mr. McKellen is still alive. She's got a son, and they still own the bar. And my father, because my father was working closely with Mr. McKellen in the 60s and 70s, and you have here some of the best whiskey in the world. You've got some McKellen 50 years old, 1938 McKellen, that you can still drink if you want every day. I mean, it's absolutely unique, not only in Paris, but in France.
And part of the story about this, and just as a reference for listeners, if you go back a couple of weeks to the interview I did with Dale DeGroff of the Museum of the American Cocktail, Harry McKellen actually left New York in 1911 to avoid prohibition, because at that time the prohibitionist craze was just getting started in the U.S. Harry McKellen saw what was coming in the U.S. and escaped to Paris, founded Harry's New York Bar here, and it's been a fixture ever since. But tell me some more about your family's connection with this place.
My family connection was really, in fact, in the 50s and the 60s, this bar was really the only place in Paris where you could find good quality whiskey. And this is exactly the same time when my father started his business, La Maison du Whiskey. And I believe the Harry's New York Bar was certainly one of the first customers of La Maison du Whiskey. And I think it's really this kind of connection that relates to La Maison Whiskey and the Harry's New York Bar. And my father was close to the father of Mr. McKellen, his son, and I knew them as well. But unfortunately, as I said today, it's a different story, different people.
Now, La Maison Whiskey is more than just a retail outlet; it's also the major whiskey importer in France, right?
Yes, we are importers since the very beginning, since 1956. For many years, people believed that La Maison Whiskey was just a shop in a little street in Paris, which is still the case. We still have this shop that was created in 1968. We had another one that was in 1961 who was closed since, but we have always been an importer. We were the first importer for Chivas in the very early 60s, and then we became importer for brands such as Lagavulin, Springbank, Caudilla, and many other brands, independent bottlers. And today we import most of the small distilleries, independent distilleries, but many American whiskey, some Irish, a lot of Japanese, and so we have a huge portfolio.
Explain to me sort of the French passion for whiskey, because we've talked about that on the previous episodes this weekend, where France is really sort of the leading export market for whiskey, other than Scotland and the U.S., and even bigger in many cases than Scotland and the U.S. Why is there such a passion for whiskey here?
This is a question that many people ask me. It's not. I don't think there is an easy answer to this question. Just for you to know where we come from. I mean, in 1956, when my father started, French market was more or less 1.5 million bottles. 52 years later, it's more or less 170 million bottles. So it's absolutely crazy. I think there are many factors that can explain this. I think there is a French culture of spirits. I think you've got a lot of cognac, armagnac, calvados. I mean, many many spirits. I think there is the attraction for exotism. I believe that American whiskey, Scottish whiskey, were very attractive for the French market, especially after World War II. You had a lot of American soldiers coming in into Europe. My father started to work with the American bases in Europe. It was his first customer, and so it was it was when everything started. And, I mean, with the American after World War II. Then I think in France you have other factors such as big groups, big companies such as Pernod Ricard. Pernod Ricard was a very big. He promoted Scottish whiskey in the early 70s. He bought some Irish distilleries in the early 70s as well. He bought Aberlour distillery. So I think it was also very key to the for the development of whiskey, because they have a fantastic sales network, and we have also a very strong supermarkets who promoted cheap whiskey. But I think this is an addition of many different factors. And also people like us who contributed a little bit with for premium whiskey, for single malt. I mean, not only us, but a few other companies. And so I think it goes back to the 50s, and it was a kind of progressive increase, but quite a big increase.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the Japanese whiskey business, and for some reason, Europe seems to really have taken to Japanese whiskeys. Looking at the Japanese booths for Suntory No. 1 drinks and Nikka today, and all weekend long at the festival, those were some of the most crowded booths at the festival. Why do you think that is?
To be honest, I think it goes beyond what I was thinking. You know, I think when we started Japanese whiskey, it was 1996. We were importing a few brands from Suntory, a blend from Suntory called Suntory Royal, and also a single malt called Yamazaki 12. At that time, we believe it was just a kind of little country for whiskey and little product, something that was a little exotic with no future. And I think it was the same for many journalists at that time, you know. And slowly, we discovered other products. Nikka came in the early 2000, and we were really amazed by the quality. I think it gave us, it pushed us to learn more about Japanese whiskey. And it's when we have been there. I've been there for Whiskey Live Japan in the late 1990, and I think it was really a shock for me, because I tasted many more Japanese whiskey. I didn't think there were so many single malts. And I tasted not only the classic range, but as well limited editions that you could find in Japan. And I think we realized at that time that it was absolutely a huge universe for whiskey, a different market, a different product. And that's how we started. And then I think it has to do with whiskey. It has to do with Japan, with the Japanese culture. I think it's like for Scottish whiskey. You know, when you like Scotch whiskey, we usually like Scotland as well. We like Japanese whiskey, but we like also the Japanese culture, the Japanese way of life. I mean, it's a different country. It's very surprising.
The Japanese whiskey craze is important enough that Mike Miyamoto, the distillery manager at Yamazaki, traveled all the way from Tokyo for Whiskey Live Paris with not just the regular line of whiskeys, but two very special ones: a heavily peated 1993 single cask Yamazaki and a 1990 sherry cask Yamazaki.
We have six different types of pot stills. Okay, each produce a different style of different character of whiskey, and also we have five different type of casks that we use. And so, you know, we've been trying to make as many different types of whiskey as possible, then come up with something new always with the combination. We don't make many peated malt at the Yamazaki distillery. But, you know, maybe every other year we make some peated malt whiskey for our own, blending for Yamazaki, single malt, 12 years old and 18 years old. But this time, we thought that maybe nice to just launch special edition of the heavily peated malt of Yamazaki.
And this is unique because, as you said, you don't do very many peated whiskeys, right? Right.
No, we don't. We need very small portion of peated malt in our single malt Yamazaki. All right. As a matter of fact. But we really don't want it. Don't want to be apparent. Okay. And so the heavily peated malt should be one of those hidden, factors of Yamazaki single malt. So that's why most of people don't notice that heavily peated malt is used in our single malt. Also, we have a Hakushu, as you know. The Hakushu is known as a slightly peated single malt whiskey because they use a lot of peated malt in their single malt recipe. Okay? But we thought that it would be nice to show the people that we also make some heavily peated malt at Yamazaki Distillery.
If you want to know more about the history of Yamazaki, check the WhiskeyCast archives for my in-depth interview with Mike Miyamoto in episode 123 from last December. But there's also the other Japanese giant to consider. Europe is Nika's largest export market, and I sat down with Nika export manager Kamaguchi Naofumi this weekend.
Even at One Distillery, we are producing this various type of whiskies, the malt whiskies. So our researcher is now studying that we have some element, the yeast or some peat contents of the malt or a kind of a cask or something like that, and how to make a distillation. But principally in Yoichi, we are still using coal to heat it up to a pot still, which is now you cannot find it even in Scotland. So we are the one who keeps the tradition of a Scotch whiskey. So it required the very high technique to adjust the fire of coal. But then we have a technician there, and the only flame of coal can make a very, very, very good taste of the malt whiskey.
Now, I know there are Scottish distillers who would argue with that, but why does coal make the best flame?
Yeah, it's it can make a very high temperature of fire, bottom of the pot still. You have some burnt smell or something on the bottom. Yeah. And also you have a straight shape of pot still. So you cannot circulate the alcohol vapor. You can go straight down to a condenser. So you can get very, very strong character of spirits. It's in a combination of shape of a pot still and fire from coal.
What are the differences between the two distilleries?
Yes, and actually, if you like, it's a very simple one. Make it simple. Whiskey from Yoichi is masculine and very powerful and peaty. And that's of Yoichi. Miyagi-kyo is something like a feminine. You have a fruity and floral and a lighter one. Yeah. We can make freely to make a various type of blend or a pure malt.
And we have whiskeys from both here. We have the 86 from Yoichi and the 86 from Miyagiko, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So the differences in these is that the Yoichi would be the more peated one of the two?
Yes, yeah, more peaty and more powerful. Yeah, and while that of Miyakyo is rather delicate and lighter and fruity and floral.
While I'm pouring a sample of the Yoichi first, what about Japanese whiskeys would surprise the average person who really doesn't know anything about Japanese whiskeys?
Yeah, but some part of the people knows about whiskey very, very much, yeah, of course. But normal people, unfortunately, market of whiskey has been shrunken. Yeah, since 20, 30 years. And it was replaced by white spirits called shochu. It's a mixable.
I'm looking at this. It's sort of a very coppery color, almost, say, the color of a copper penny or a copper coin, or a copper euro coin, as the case may be, since we're in Paris. And the nose, I'm getting the smokiness of the peat, of the coal smoke. Maybe some dried fruits a little bit. Maybe some dried apricots, some figs and some plums. Let's see. I'm very smoky on the taste. You're right about the... it's almost like an islet in many ways with the, as you point out, the Miyako is the, where's the geographics on that? Where is that one located?
Miyako. Miyako is in, Tokyo there, and Yoichi in the north. So Miyako is in between. Yeah, just in center, in Honshu area. Yeah. It's surrounded by woods. Well, the Yoichi is in seashore.
Which would explain the more isla-like characteristics of the Yoichi.
Yeah, you have some kind of salty flavors inside.
And pouring the second one now. And these are both from the same year, both 1986. Both bottled 2008, right about the same time. So they're both exactly identical in age, pretty much. Both at pretty much cask strength, almost 59% for the Yoichi, and the Miyako is 63%. So these are both whoppers in terms of strength by alcohol. Now, while I'm nosing this one, you pointed out that the market is getting smaller for these whiskeys. Let me ask you the $64 question. As the American term would go, there are many markets that unfortunately don't get to see these whiskeys, one of them being the United States. Why do we not get to see Nikas exported more widely?
U.S., it's a little bit difficult. So you need a distributor in each state. Yeah. And luckily, we found a very, very good distributor in Europe who has an enthusiasm and a passion on our whiskey. They are expanding the sales of our whiskey. But we have not found this kind of a distributor in the U.S.
Now, I'm nosing this, and I get the more floral notes. I get a little bit of dry grass, straw, heathery notes. More herbal notes, as you mentioned, and on the taste, I get that as well with a bit of the lighter, as you mentioned, the lighter fruitier notes as well. Perhaps some apricots, a little bit of maybe some dried apples, things like that. And these are both being tasted without water, so I'm sure water would open these up both dramatically. But where does the future lie for these whiskeys? Since you're basically at the point where you can sell almost everything you make now, are you able to increase production to the point where you could expand markets if you need to?
Yes, we're now forecasting that the high-end whiskey will be expanding. It's a tendency of every consuming product, like it's a polarization. You have a commodity product or ultra or premium high-end products. These kind of things is including to very, very super premium products. So this sector should be growing. Even the volume of the consumption is not expanding.
Just to give you an idea of how creative Nika can be, I had the chance to try a 12-year-old malt whiskey produced in a coffee still exclusively for La Maison du Whisky. It was spicy and dry with a nose of dried leaves and straw, perfect for an autumn day in Paris. The taste revealed black pepper and cilantro, leading to a citrusy finish of lemon and lime. I scored it a 93. There were only two other whiskeys that I rated higher this weekend. One was the 1972 Glendronach I mentioned in the last episode, and the other one was right here at Harry's. It was a 1966 Mortlach bottled in 1988. The nose was dark chocolate and walnut liqueur with a hint of hazelnut and balsamic vinegar, and the taste, black licorice and vintage leather with a touch of spice and a smooth finish that didn't show its vintage a bit. I scored them both a 95. Now, let me ask you real quickly, Terry, what do you see as the future now for the whiskey business? Because it looks as though we're in the middle of a whiskey boom, and there are a lot of markets that are demanding more and more from the whiskey business and from the whiskey distillers, and trying to take more and more market share almost away from the established markets like France, like Scotland and the UK and the US. Where do you see the future?
Yes, it's true that in the last 2-3 years we have seen a lot of problems with especially independent bottlers. We used to get a lot of fantastic product from independent bottlers, and it is becoming more and more difficult to find quality cask. Hopefully there are still a few that are here in the market, such as Gordon MacPhail, Signature Vintage, and a few others who can still have access to this market. I mean, the fact that those people own distillery gives them some access to a high-quality product. At the same time, I think there are a lot of smaller distilleries, independent distilleries. Recently, the Ben Riach distillery just bought Glendronach distillery, which is quite, I think, a good news for Glendronach, because it was not a real strategic product for Pernod Ricard. So I believe it will come from people like this, like smaller distilleries, independent distilleries. You see also new markets such as micro distillery in the US, smaller distillery in France, distillery from India, or distillery in Japan as well. I think it will come from a more diverse number of countries and different type of distilleries than before.
I couldn't let you go without talking about some of the French distilleries, because you have some very interesting whiskies being produced right here locally in France.
Yes, we have a lot of distilleries. I mean, the most famous one are on the West Coast in Brittany. There is a whiskey produced with black wheat. I think it's one of the most interesting, called Edu. Unfortunately, they were not here on the show this year, but they have been here over the last 3 years. And it's a very good whiskey, by the way. You've got also whiskey on the East Coast, I mean in Alsace, in Champagne, in Corsica, which is quite amazing. And I think there are many more producers, eau de vie producers, who might produce whiskey in the future. It's a little bit like in the US. I know that micro distillery, usually they don't only produce whiskey, but they produce also eau de vie, vodka, and other type of spirits. So it's a kind of the same kind of production and trend.
Before I wrap things up, I want to thank you for your hospitality this weekend. You and your staff and the staff at Whiskey Magazine France have just been amazingly wonderful. This has been a wonderful weekend, and I would like to thank you all for making this a very special weekend for me and for everyone who listens to the show.
And thank you for coming. Thank you for accepting the invitation as well. I think it was great to have you on the show, and I think I'm sure we have a lot to learn by listening Whiskey Cast, and I hope you come next year.
I hope so too.
Now, before I wrap things up, let's check the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. This coming weekend, I'll be in Lebanon, Kentucky for the Marion County Country Ham Days Festival, where they're honoring the local cooperages that make the barrels for the area's bourbon distilleries, and by extension, much of the rest of the whiskey world. This weekend is also the Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival in Dufton, and the final weekend of the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival in Sweden, the Whiskey by the Sea Festival in Vlissingen, the Netherlands, and the Brooklyn Bourbon Festival at Lanell's in New York City. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla at Laphroaig.com. That's all for this special episode from Harry's New York Bar at St. Croix de Nuit in Paris. There's a link to Harry's in the Great Whiskey Bars section on the links page of the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find my whiskey ratings, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address for your questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. Once again, special thanks to the entire staff of Whiskey Magazine France and La Maison de Whiskey for their hospitality this weekend, along with the folks at Harry's New York Bar. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening, and from Paris, au revoir.